This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, November 14th, 2017.
My name is Beverly Young Nelson.
A new voice in the chorus of allegations against Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. Yesterday, Beverly Young Nelson told the nation her story of being assaulted by Moore decades ago when she was just 16 years old. Nelson worked as a waitress in Gadsden, Alabama. Roy Moore, she says, was a regular customer.
When he was at the restaurant, he would speak to me and would sometimes pull the ends of my long hair as I walked by him. He would compliment me on my looks, and I did not think anything of it. I did nothing to encourage his flirtatious behavior.
Nelson recounts knowing that Roy Moore was an important man back then, respected in the community. Then one night, Nelson says Roy Moore offered her a ride home. And a note to listeners here, this testimony is disturbing.
Mr. Moore reached over and began groping me and putting his hands on my breast. I tried to open my car door to leave, but he reached over and he locked it so I could not get out. I tried fighting him off while yelling at him to stop. But instead of stopping, he began squeezing my neck, attempting to force my head onto his crotch. I was terrified. He was also trying to pull my shirt off. I thought that he was going to rape me. I was twisting, and I was struggling, and I was begging him to stop. I had tears running down my face. At some point, he gave up. And he then looked at me and he told me, he said, "You're just a child." And he said, "I am the district attorney of Etowah County. And if you tell anyone about this, no one will ever believe you."
Beverly Young Nelson there yesterday with her story of being assaulted by Roy Moore. Nelson says she and her husband voted for President Trump and that her speaking out has nothing to do with politics. Well, politics are now an inevitable part of this story. Last week, many GOP officials in Alabama spoke out in defense of Roy Moore. So following Nelson's testimony yesterday, we reached out to more than a dozen Republican leaders from the state. And so far, we've only heard back from the office of Alabama State Auditor Jim Ziegler, whose executive assistant told us Mr. Ziegler is attempting to get information on the falsehoods of these allegations. As soon as he gets that information, he'll contact you. Pat Duggins is news director for Alabama Public Radio, who's been keeping us up to date on everything going on in Alabama over the last few weeks. Pat, thanks for coming back.
Hi, Todd. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, Pat, we tried to survey prominent Republicans in Alabama. As I mentioned, we didn't get too far. I know you've gotten further than we have. So what are Republicans in the state saying after these last allegations from Beverly Young Nelson?
Well, Todd, it's been a lot of kind of like a tale of two parties, because up in Washington, you've got a big sea change. You know, Mitch McConnell taking the side of the women who are making the allegations against Roy Moore. But as you say, here in Alabama, it seems as though that the Republicans are still staunchly behind Roy Moore. And of course, we referred to yesterday the fact that one of them said even if the allegations of sexual assault turn out to be true, they're still going to vote for him as opposed to going for a Democrat. So it's kind of the same thing. We're just kind of like waiting for the next shoe to drop after Beverly Young Nelson's testimony.
And it really is kind of a shocking development from afar, at least, Pat Duggins. I mean, I know that Roy Moore has lots of allies in Alabama and lots of people who think the media is out to get him. I get it. But the state also has a lot of conservative evangelical voters who have made a lot over the last few decades of voting on their morals and voting on their conscience. And I'm a little bit surprised that this hasn't shocked both.
Well, there's been a lot of really good reporting on that, Todd, regarding evangelicals that are really kind of coming to grips with whether or not if a politician thumps the Bible, is that a get-out-of-jail-free card? Now, Roy Moore has done it. Before that, Robert Bentley wore his Christian faith on his sleeve, and yet he was drummed out of office following being recorded making sexually explicit comments to an aide. It's just, you know, it would be interesting to see, and we're not really going to know until December 12th, until whether or not it's enough for these evangelicals to say, okay, we do have redemption, we do have forgiveness, let's give Roy Moore a pass, or are they just simply past the, okay, I'm holding my nose point, and they're just going to do the unthinkable in Alabama, and let's go for Democrat Doug Jones.
And aside from the abuse that's alleged, the local politics of this may be the most important thing in Roy Moore's future for the next month. Until national Republicans get a hold of him, if he manages to win Pat Duggins, here's the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell asked yesterday about how he's now feeling about Roy Moore.
I believe the women, yes.
Pat, that's the Senate Majority Leader. Cory Gardner, who's a senator from Colorado and heads up the Senate Republicans campaign arm, has said that if Roy Moore is elected, senators should vote to expel him and kick him out.
Well, there's that. There's also the possibility of a write-in candidate between now and Election Day. Now, Luther Strange, who was Alabama's former attorney general, who told the State House to stop investigating Governor Robert Bentley for alleged sexual improprieties, and that he would take it over, and then all of a sudden, when Jeff Sessions goes off to become attorney general, guess who Governor Robert Bentley nominates to be the fill-in U.S. Senator? Luther Strange. He's already said point blank, you can forget him for a write-in candidate. And then the real interesting scenario is whether or not Republicans in Washington could convince Jeff Sessions to leave as AG. A lot of different moving parts between now and December.
A lot of twists and turns possible between now and December, and it's a lot of politics. I get it. But Pat Duggins, there's a fundamental truth between now and December, too, that with all of these Republican leaders in Washington now saying that Roy Moore should be expelled, even if he's elected, that he should never be a senator. They are not saying that there's an election going on in Alabama and that Doug Jones is the better choice. I get that he's a Democrat, but there's one thing left unsaid, which is who should win this election?
Well, the interesting thing about it is that a lot of people who are supporting Roy Moore are saying, well, all of these allegations are 40 years old and there's no way that you could possibly prove that. Democrat Doug Jones did exactly that when he convicted not one but two members of the Ku Klux Klan for the 1963 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham. His contention to his followers, I was attending a rally where he said, listen, if you're on the right side of history, you can do anything. And for someone in Alabama to say that, because a lot of people will come up to me, you know, I've been here like 8 years, and a lot of people will come up to me and say, listen, we're tired of being a national punchline, we're tired of being a joke, and here's Doug Jones saying it in a public forum in a race where the polls show them neck and neck. For people in Alabama, that's revelation time. That's like, you know, an interview with Elvis's ghost would rank right up with there. But we have to see whether or not that helps him between now and December.
Well, of course, this is a political story. Pat Duggins, you and I are doing a lot of political analysis. It's important. But maybe more important, I wonder with this episode how many people in Alabama are talking about what's at the core of this whole issue, which is the sexual abuse of girls.
Well, there was an interesting article in our local paper here in Tuscaloosa that said that, and this is I'm paraphrasing the person who wrote the editorial, that if Roy Moore wins and if Roy Moore goes to Washington, it will determine whether or not Alabama voters can actually be embarrassed.
Pat Duggins, news director for Alabama Public Radio. Pat, thanks again.
Thank you, Todd.
Let's stay with another Alabama story now that's on the mind of U.S. senators in Washington, because they have the job of deciding whether 36-year-old Brett J. Talley should be confirmed to a lifetime appointment as a federal judge. President Trump nominated the Harvard Law graduate to be a U.S. district judge for the Middle District of Alabama, despite the fact that Talley has never tried a case. The American Bar Association is not impressed. It gave Talley a rating of not qualified for a seat on the federal bench. Still, Republicans so far have been fine with Brett J. Talley. All of the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee supported his nomination last week. David Latt is an attorney and founding editor of the legal news website Above the Law.
So, in my opinion, I think Brett Talley is qualified to be a judge. I don't know whether I would say he is the best qualified for this position, but he does have a broad range of experience. He has had a close-up experience in terms of working as a clerk. If anything, I think the most fair thing to say about this nomination is it's premature. I think Brett Talley would have been an excellent nominee 10 years, maybe even 5 years from now. Right now, it's premature, but as a baseline matter, is he qualified? I would say yes.
Now, you know my next question, because the American Bar Association disagrees with you, David Latt. It's very, very rare for that organization to give out a not qualified rating for a federal nominee, but they gave one to Brett Talley.
So there are a couple of caveats about the ABA ratings. With respect to the Trump administration, the Trump administration has changed the Obama-era policy of giving the ABA advance peeks or sneak peeks at the nominees. The Obama administration would let the ABA look at the nominees before the nominations were announced, give the Obama administration its rating, and then the administration could decide whether or not to go forward. So Obama's administration asked the ABA to rate 185 or so nominees at one point in the administration, and 14 of them were rated not qualified. The Obama administration then decided not to nominate those people. The Trump administration is less sympathetic to or interested in the ABA's views. They criticize the ABA as left-leaning. And so they have not been giving the ABA advanced peaks. And so as a result, some of their nominees are going to get dinged as not qualified.
So Brett J. Talley's qualifications have come to the fore here as the Trump administration nominates a lot of judges. But David Latt, there's another issue that's come up in the last couple of days, as reported by our partner, the New York Times, that in his disclosures to the Senate, Brett Talley did not tell senators that he's married to the chief of staff of the White House counsel. Is that a significant omission?
So I think that he probably should have mentioned that just to, be upfront about it. But it wasn't exactly a secret. Anyone with Google would have known that Ann Donaldson, who's the chief of staff to the White House counsel, is married to Brett Talley. I mentioned it on Above the Law back in April. And if you look at the specific question on the questionnaire, it says, what communications have you had with the White House regarding this nomination? Typically, that's where the nominees talk about how they were approached by the White House. So it's not exactly the place where you would say, well, you know, I was chatting over the dinner table with my wife. It's really more about how were you officially approached about being a judicial nominee. So I can see why he didn't disclose that. I think he should have, because he would have saved himself a lot of headaches, certainly.
Well, let's take a step back then for just a moment from the specific case of Brett J. Talley, because it's pretty rare for judges at this level to get so much public attention. What's been going on behind the scenes, David Latt, as you know, is that while the country is focused on Roy Moore and China and North Korea and a big tax bill and a lot of other issues at the same time, Republicans in the Senate and President Trump have been busy filling dozens of vacancies in the federal court system with conservatives. Neil Gorsuch was just the start of this trend, and pretty quietly, Republicans have been filling the courts.
Yes, absolutely. And this is something that progressives need to be aware of, because these courts are very important. Now, trial courts, I would say, are less important than the appeals courts, because a lot of the cases decided in trial courts are not controversial, are not politically charged, and they go up to the appeals court if one of the parties wants to seek an appeal. So in some ways, Talley's court is not the final word here, but on a lot of the middle courts, the intermediate appeals courts right below the Supreme Court, those courts are the final word for thousands of cases, because the Supreme Court looks at only about 80 cases a year. Hundreds of thousands of cases go through the federal system. And so those courts are being stalked by people who will serve for life. And I think people need to be aware of that.
So, David Latt, I hear you saying that the outcry over Brett J. Talley is a bit overblown, not only his qualifications, but his disclosures, his age, his experience, and everything else. But you don't get out of here without walking into the well, Senator Latt, and voting up or down. You said this nomination is premature. Brett J. Talley, yay or nay?
I would vote yay. With some, not enthusiastically, but I think he is qualified to serve on the federal bench.
David Latt, founding editor of Above the Law, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. Most weeks here on the show, we take a look at the legal system with Case in Point from our friends at the Marshall Project. And this week's case takes us back to Chicago in 2009.
This is a case that arises out of the gangs of Chicago. You have a young man, 17 at the time of the alleged crime, Djurdjilov, who is accused of essentially helping to set fire to an apartment that ended up resulting in the death of two innocent people. He was questioned over and over again by the police, and in the end you have essentially a conviction that sends him to prison for decades and decades and decades.
That's Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project, and he's talking about the 2014 conviction of Jovan Djurdjilov, who was found guilty of arson and two counts of first-degree murder. Djurdjilov was sentenced to 90 years in prison, but the story doesn't end there.
He appeals, and basically makes two arguments. One, that his interrogation by the Chicago police in Cook County, that it was coercive to the point where whatever he said should not have been told to jurors. And he says that when he asked for, or when his attorney asked for, money to hire an expert to look at cell phone records, which were critical to the prosecution's case, the judge refused to do that. Turns out it was the cell phone request that ends up giving Dzhurdjulov a new trial, or at least a chance for a new trial, which is where the case stands today.
Still, it's those 36 hours of on and off interrogation by Chicago police that Andrew says raised some red flags for Case in Point.
During that, you have sort of the textbook good cop, bad cop scenario where he is threatened and cajoled into giving a statement. At one point, and this is why I thought the case was worth mentioning, they essentially threaten him with the death penalty. They say that if he doesn't talk, he is going to get the needle. But he could not ever have been given the death penalty because he was under the age of 18 at the time the crime was committed. And we have noticed that this is a theme in many of these interrogations. Even when someone is categorically precluded from capital punishment, the police threaten it anyway, hoping that it is going to elicit some sort of a statement.
But we should be clear, Dzhurdjulov confessed to this crime, right?
Well, he made incriminating statements. He made statements that were inconsistent. First, he said one thing about his role in the crime, then he said something else, and then he said a third thing. And of course, prosecutors at the trial were able to say, listen, this is a guy who made inconsistent statements that tend to incriminate him. That and other evidence, some of it very shaky, quite frankly, generates the conviction here. So this is not, as we know it today, a case of a false confession. What we learn from the case, though, is that the cops during these interrogations can really lie about the facts or the evidence either presented to them or not presented to them. They could try to fool a suspect, but then they get into trouble when they make legal pronouncements during an interrogation. And this case is one of those cases that sort of straddles that line.
Well, I want to bring in Clara Stevens here. Clara is a research scholar at the National Registry of Exonerations and an expert on police interrogations. What exactly, Clara, are police allowed to do in an interrogation like that? They're certainly allowed to try to fool the suspect. They're allowed to try to promise them things, I suppose. But Andrew is saying legally, he could have never gotten the needle, as they said. Is that illegal?
Well, the Supreme Court hasn't specifically ruled on that yet. As you can see in most of these Supreme Court cases, the decisions turn on a really specific fact pattern. And this specific issue of threatening a death penalty, whether or not it is legal even, has not been ruled on one way or the other. In our research, we consider that any threat of the death penalty, whether, you know, eventually they could potentially be put to death, is misconduct.
What about other types of manipulations that might take place in interrogation, like walking in from the other room and saying, you know, your friend just flipped on you. He just dropped a dime on you. You better come clean. That may or may not be true, but that's allowed, right?
Yes, that is allowed. Another thing that we often see in false confessions is the use of polygraphs. So a suspect will be polygraphed and the result will be positive, negative, inconclusive, whatever it is. But the officer will lie and say, you failed this polygraph. We know you're lying. Just admit to us that you did this. There are very few restrictions on what an officer can or can't lie about in interrogations like this.
Well, we should make the point that we don't know whether Jovan Dzhurdjulov's confession was false or not, and his original conviction was not overturned on that basis. But Clara, what do we know about different police tactics in interrogations and how they can influence confessions that come from suspects?
Well, we broadly classify those into misconduct and non-misconduct. For the misconduct, those would be things like offering a plea bargain. Police officers are not legally allowed to offer a plea bargain. But then there are things that I am personally troubled by, but that are not illegal, and that some in the law enforcement profession would say are important tools to get actually guilty people to admit to what they did, because of course that's never in their interest or hardly ever. So some of the things that they do is they offer promises, things like if you just admit what you did, you can go home. Or if you admit what you know, or tell me something I want to know and you can go home. And then another one is feeding details. So officers can tell the suspect exactly what happened in the crime in an effort to get them to parrot it back to them.
So, Andrew Cohen, what does all of this say, Clara's analysis here? What does all of it say about the state of interrogation? Every jurisdiction is different. What can we conclude about Jovan Gergelov's case?
To me, it's a window, this case is, into police tactics. It's a window into reform that has come to some of these rooms where suspects are being grilled about a murder. But it's also a recognition that the courts aren't doing a very good job of making sure that coercion isn't actually what most of us would think of when we think of coercion.
Clara, is there a law in every jurisdiction or every state that confessions of this kind, interrogations, have to be videotaped? Seems like it was very useful in this case. Do the cops have to do it?
No, they do not. In most places, that is not the case. And as Andrew said correctly, that is one of the main policy goals of reformers, because it prevents police from engaging in misconduct, and this helps alleviate some of that. And it also makes it possible for judges and juries to evaluate these confessions realistically and in context. But it's true, in most places, there is no law that you have to record interrogations either by video or by audio.
Clara Stevens is research scholar at the National Registry of Exonerations. Clara, thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And as always, Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project. Thanks, Andrew.
It's my pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
We've been following the war and the famine in Yemen on The Takeaway, and that famine is getting worse. Nearly 7 million people in Yemen are facing starvation now after Saudi blockades closed off ports and airports and roads for the last 8 days. Saudi Arabia's UN ambassador has denied the blockade, saying it was only a temporary procedure and that the blockades would be lifted to allow aid into the country. Suze Van Meegen is protection and advocacy advisor with the Norwegian Refugee Council based in Yemen. Suze, thanks for being here.
Great. Thanks for your time, Todd.
Suze, you're in Amman, Jordan right now. You were in Yemen just a couple of weeks ago. What were conditions like there before the blockade started?
Yemen is now the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. So conditions are as bad as you can imagine. There's 7 million people on the brink of famine, 17 million people without enough access to food each day, and 21 million people in need of aid. So they're just numbers. But in terms of the impact on the lives of people, the situation is very, very bad. It's life or death.
Suze, we've been following the famine in Yemen for many, many months, and unfortunately, it's not a new story. How has this new blockade from Saudi Arabia made things worse?
You're right. It's not a new story, but it's deteriorating every single day. So previously, we were seeing that goods were delayed getting into Yemen. People didn't have enough access to food. Medicines were slowed. What we're seeing now is that nothing is getting into Yemen. So the closure of airports and seaports effectively means that people inside Yemen are being held to ransom without access to any goods. What that means for people in Yemen is that they can't afford what's still there. So petrol, medicine, food have all become very precious commodities, and the prices are increasing every day, pricing people out of the market and meaning they can't get what they need to survive.
It's one thing to talk about this from far away, Suze. Can you describe at the village level, the villages that you visited, what all of this looks like?
I can tell you that for people in Yemen, people previously had lives, they had jobs, they had houses, and now it is a country absolutely destroyed by war and disease in a way that people could never have predicted. For the people I work with, who have been university educated, these are people with jobs and families, they're moving away from areas to avoid airstrikes hitting their houses. They're worried about their safety. People can't get to work because they can't afford enough fuel for their cars, and public transport is closing down. There are people leaving their homes with only the clothes that they're wearing and having to move into very congested living conditions. And then on top of all of this, we have a cholera crisis that is approaching 1 million cases. So people are afraid of disease. They can't get enough water. I mean, the list is very, very long.
And what has the government of Saudi Arabia said here? We know about the ongoing war and the proxies that are involved in Yemen. The Saudis have implemented this blockade that you mentioned on ports and also on airports because of the war. What have they said about lifting some of the pressure here?
What we've heard in the last 24 hours is that the Saudi-led coalition will lift the blockade in areas controlled by the internationally recognized government of Yemen. So what that means is that areas in the south of the country, where approximately 15% of the population live, will be able to get ships and possibly flights coming in with commercial goods and humanitarian supplies. That, while that is welcome, it's not enough. We need every port in Yemen open so that everybody can be reached with the goods they need.
Suze Van Meegen, as I mentioned, you're in Amman, Jordan now. You haven't been in Yemen for a little over 2 weeks. Are you able to get back to the country?
Not at this stage. The plan was for me to travel back to Yemen this week. That is where I want to be. That's where our work is. But much like up to 200 aid workers, I'm stuck outside the country while the blockade is in place. All flights have been stopped, meaning we can't get in and our colleagues in the country can't get out.
Suze Van Meegen with the Norwegian Refugee Council. Thank you, Suze.
Thanks for your time, Todd.
The 2017 UN Climate Change Conference is going on in Bonn, Germany right now, and delegates at the conference are facing some disturbing scientific findings. Corinne Lekiri is director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research at the University of East Anglia in England and a lead researcher on the Global Carbon Project. Corinne, you're there in Bonn, Germany right now. Talk about your findings. What did you find?
So we have analyzed the emissions of carbon, the biggest culprit for climate change, and we find in 2017 that the emissions are expected to rise again after having been stable for 3 years. So this is not good news here in Bonn.
Rise how much?
2% is our best estimate. Now, of course, the year's not yet finished, so it could be still vary a bit around that, but it does definitely look like a rise.
Is 2% a lot in the global carbon load if you look at a three-year plateau and then an uptick of 2%? Is that a worry?
Yeah, absolutely, actually. 2% is a lot. Emissions really need to peak and start declining now. So an increase of 2% is pretty much unexpected at this stage. We thought we were beyond these high levels of increase in emissions we've seen in the past 10, 20 years. We thought we were beyond that, but it does look like it's not yet there.
And have you and other researchers discovered a cause?
Behind this is primarily what's happening in China. So Chinese emissions were going down for 2 years, and this year the industrial growth has picked up a little, possibly in part from stimulus by the government. So it could be a one-off, and then next year it stabilizes again. But also, in addition to China, the emissions in the U.S. and in Europe as well, they had been declining in the past 10 years, and this year the decline is quite small compared to the previous decade, so that's contributing as well.
So what are delegates and researchers at the conference saying about your findings, Corinne? I mean, we have the Paris Climate Accords. Of course, the United States, we're backing away from those accords now. That's big news. The rest of the world is in. The agreement doesn't take effect right away. It's only a year or two old. But what are people saying about the trajectory here?
There's a lot of talk about the implementation here in Bonn, but the implementation is kind of pushed to a little bit later, 2020 and after that. And really, to tackle climate change, the implementation needs to start now. So there has to be also discussions about what is going to happen now this year and next year, 2018, in the countries around the world. So what we would like to see happening is the delegates here go back to their countries and then start the policies and actions that are needed.
And we don't want to put all the blame for this on China, of course. They're far from the sole cause of this uptick. But if they are the plurality of the increase in carbon load, what are the Chinese delegates saying about their country and their continuing need to industrialize?
The Chinese are doing really massive efforts to deploy renewable in particular, to clean their energy production, to clean their atmosphere of pollution. So we do see signs that the economy is rebalancing. There's a bit more control. You have the impression in the energy production in China. The government is making statements about climate change, about being in harmony with the planet. All these things are indications that in China, at least, one has the impression in the next few years, the emissions are going to be a little bit more under control. So that gives an opportunity to the rest of the planet to actually make these emissions go down.
And let's not put all of the attention on China. Look, as we mentioned, the United States is backing away from Paris, but there's still a lot going on in the American economy with renewables. There's a huge solar industry here. How are delegates feeling about the United States overall right now?
Well, the U.S. Pulling out of the Paris Agreement is a big blow for the delegates, but there's a lot of activity going on from U.S. Representatives here in Bonn that talk about implementing the Paris Agreement nevertheless. So make those policies and action meaningful at the state level or in cities around the U.S. And that's actually viewed as really very important, if not more important, because what happens on the ground is really what makes the difference in terms of the emissions.
Corinne Lakiri with the Global Carbon Project, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Delegates at the Global Climate Conference got some bad news on carbon emissions. Here at home, the EPA is taking steps that could make it harder to regulate carbon and other pollutants too. 2 weeks ago, Administrator Scott Pruitt announced that scientists who get EPA research grants can no longer serve on the agency's scientific advisory committees. Here's Pruitt.
There's a story about Joshua leading the people of Israel. And Joshua says to the people of Israel, choose this day whom you're going to serve. And I would say to you, this is sort of like the Joshua principle, that as it relates to grants from this agency, you're going to have to choose either service on the committee or choose the grant, but you can't do both.
Now, there is no similar biblical standard at the EPA for advisors who get grants from outside sources, including industry, and that has researchers like Joe Arvai questioning Pruitt's motives here. Joe Arvai served as an EPA science advisor and got EPA research grants. His six-year advisor's term was not renewed by the agency this past September. Arvai is currently director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprises at the University of Michigan, and he joins me now. Joe, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
So how do you see this decision from the administrator, Scott Pruitt, to bar scientists who get EPA grants from the Science Advisory Board?
I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, I see it as quite disingenuous. I think he's coming at this from the perspective that certain scientists have a conflict of interest and therefore should be ruled out of serving in an independent science advisory capacity. But I think if you peel back just even the thinnest layers on top of that, you'll see that this has very little to do with conflict of interest and much more to do with his deregulatory agenda and how he wants to make it happen and how he wants to make it look legitimate.
All right, well, let's deal with the argument about conflict of interest first, because on the face of it, it seems like Scott Pruitt has a point. If you're a scientist who gets money from the EPA and you serve on a science advisory board, you might be conflicted, and the advice that you give the EPA could be colored by the fact that you want to preserve your big research grant, right?
You know, I've heard that argument made a couple of times. I think it's flawed for a couple of reasons. I think the first one is that the motivation to keep your research grant is really predicated upon the quality of the science that you end up doing and not what you end up saying with the science that you're doing. What I mean by that is that the data you collect ultimately speaks for itself. So the notion that somehow those scientists would receive a grant, would twist the data to satisfy the EPA just to hang on to grants seems somewhat silly. I'd add that researchers who are working with grants have to go through very stringent peer review processes, very stringent conflict of interest processes, both at their home institutions and at the EPA. And on top of that, it's not like they're taking that money home with them to, you know, pay their mortgage. They're using it to pay direct research costs. So, you know, the incentive that one might think would be there from looking at this from the outside, those incentives aren't actually there in real life.
One argument here is that this works the other way all the time. When people from industry have a conflict of interest, they have to do huge amounts of disclosure, but there are some advisory committees that they can't serve on because of conflict of interest that they might just be trying to serve their industry and not the data.
And I think this is actually a really good point. And I think it really sort of uncovers the hypocrisy of Pruitt's decision. So if you look at EPA Science Advisory Board members who may have received EPA grants in the past, I'll use myself as an example. I received a grant from the EPA in, it was 1999. And I think my share of that grant was about $100,000. That money was used to pay direct research expenses. It was used to pay participants in the research. It was used to pay for publishing costs and so forth. None of that money went into my pocket. And when you go through conflict of interest reviews at the EPA, so when I went through mine before joining the EPA Science Advisory Board back in 2011, I had to disclose where my grant money came from. I had to disclose what kinds of consulting agreements I had. I had to disclose what kinds of industry groups that I was working with. And there were some pretty basic rules. One was that if you were doing independent research where the grants were running through your institution, the University of Michigan in my case, those grants were reviewed by grant officers at the university and by grant officers at the EPA or another federal agency like the National Science Foundation. If you contrast that to what's happening with the EPA and some of its other advisors, I'll give you an example of Mike Honeycutt, who's now been named as the chair of the EPA's Independent Science Advisory Board. His agency received $48.5 million from the federal government last year, much of it from the EPA. So I would argue that there's much more conflict of interest tied up in Mike Honeycutt's service than there was in mine. So I hear what you're saying in terms of there's sort of this background incentive there for scientists to want to please the EPA in order to protect their research grants and ultimately perhaps protect their careers. I guess what I'm arguing is that processes for making sure that material conflicts of interest don't come into play when it comes to the advice those advisors are giving to the EPA or any other federal agency are stringent, have been in place for a very long time. And what you're seeing from Scott Pruitt now is a rather hypocritical suggestion that somehow he's got to change the rules now because they weren't working effectively in the past.
So, Joe, if you're not buying it, what do you think Scott Pruitt is up to? Why would he want to get all of these scientists like you who have EPA grants out of the way?
I think that there are a couple of reasons behind this. I think the first is that it looks good from the standpoint of the deregulatory agenda set forth by Donald Trump and Scott Pruitt if you can really rattle the cages of those pesky liberal scientists that are standing in the way of regulation. So this all looks good from the standpoint of their base in terms of the election promises that Donald Trump made a year ago. So there's a real kind of political expediency and political imagery aspect to this. At the same time, I think there's a very real concern here that when it comes to some of the questions that Scott Pruitt wants to address from the standpoint of deregulation, perhaps the Clean Power Plan around climate change, he can now, through this set of decisions, basically begin to wipe the slate of EPA advisors clean, start to appoint people to the boards like Mike Honeycutt, like Bob Blands, people who are very friendly to his agenda, who can hide behind their scientific credentials and not get exposed to the same kinds of scrutiny about conflicts of interest as others. He can use their advice, which is obviously going to pander to his agenda, as a way to bolster his own claims that it's okay to roll back clean air regulations. It's okay to roll back regulations that would limit the amount of greenhouse gas emissions getting into the atmosphere. So I think there's a very real and dangerous element to what Scott Pruitt is doing. And I think ultimately it's going to be the health of Americans and the health of the American environment that suffers.
So you're suggesting then that some of this is as simple as clearing out some seats on the board using scientific conflict of interest and being able to fill those seats with your handpicked people.
That's absolutely right. And I think just by the decision he made a couple of weeks ago, he's been able to clear out a third of those science advisors. Next year, he'll have another opportunity to clear out another third of those science advisories. In year three, another third. And by that point, he'll have basically tilted the science advisory board in the direction of his agenda.
Joe Arvai, thanks for being with us again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joe Arvai is a former member of the EPA Science Advisory Board. He's now director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us on The Takeaway today. The nation is now wrestling with revelations of sexual harassment and sexual abuse by high-profile men. Meanwhile, in thousands and millions of everyday workplaces and campuses across the country, attitudes about sexual harassment are changing. But just how they're changing is a major focus of Dr. Denise Cummins' research. Cummins is a cognitive scientist. She's an author and a fellow of the Association for Psychological Science. She's here to talk about how demographic changes are helping influence sexual harassment and its place in the culture.
I think we're getting a little bit better in defining what sexual harassment is. And we're also finding large sex differences and generational differences in terms of tolerance towards behaviors that are classified as sexual harassment.
You talk about changing attitudes and generational differences. Describe some of those differences that you've seen.
Millennial women are far less tolerant of sexual harassment than are millennial men. And they are also far less tolerant than any other generation. So what we're seeing is a rise of millennial women. Baby boomers and Gen X worked very hard to put in place laws and workplace rules to protect women from sexual harassment. And what we're seeing is that millennial women are flexing their muscles, and they are actually making use of these laws. The problem is that the millennial men seem to be lagging a little bit behind.
How far behind?
There is definitely a sex difference in attitude towards sexual harassment. So a very simple example is there was a recent online survey, and they found that 2 out of 3 men don't think repeated unwanted invitations to drinks, dinner, or dates constitute sexual harassment. They think this is just being persistent, whereas virtually all the women thought that this was sexual harassment. So we have a slippage in terms of how each sex views or defines what sexual harassment is. I think the more important question is why? Why are we seeing these differences? So millennial men in particular grew up in a culture that is more tolerant of sexual aggression than previous generations, believe it or not, particularly on college campuses. This could be because more women succeed in school and life, and it seems harder for men to respect them and to respect themselves as a result of that. So I think we're very familiar with the fact that there women are outstripping men in terms of enrollment on college campuses. So when women outnumber men in college, men are especially likely to dictate the terms of the relationships that they enter into. Casual sex is often narrowly focused on male pleasure. And interestingly, most of the respondents indicated they had never been instructed by parents or other authorities about simple things like being sure your partner wants to have sex before having sex. I'd also like to, and I know this may be somewhat controversial, but I think college professors are part of the problem here. It is not that unusual for college students to be preyed on sexually by professors, and there have been many high-profile cases in the news recently of tenured professors losing their jobs over preying on their students. However, that's not the way that the professoriate tends to see things. So this is the climate, the social climate within which millennials have come of age. And there's another issue that I think is rather important. There's a definite male-female difference in terms of reading social signals. Women generally are better at reading them than are men. It's something that's called theory of mind or mind reading, and women generally outperform men on these kinds of tasks that require you to interpret facial expressions. And what they found was that men were able to change their perceptions of sexual interest when told to focus on the nonverbal cues and less on the attractiveness of the women.
Dr. Cummins, could that education be as simple as making facial recognition education, if that's what you want to call it, part of sexual harassment training that so many people go through at their work? I mean, if young millennial men who are joining the workforce have a hard time or a harder time recognizing these cues, is it enough to make it part of that training to make them aware of it?
I think that would actually benefit them quite a bit, because it sounds like we're beating up on millennial men, and I don't want to be doing that, because in many other ways, millennial men are changing the workplace for the better for their female coworkers. Millennial men, compared to older men, were far more likely to be part of a dual-income household and to contribute to childcare. And critically, that meant that they were more willing to adapt their behaviors to support their female coworkers. It's an economic issue because so much sexual harassment occurs in the workplace.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that generational difference, Dr. Cummins. I have a relative who's retired, a woman, who I would not describe as someone who's conservative at all, but who spent her career working around a lot of male executives. We were talking about this issue, and this relative rolled her eyes at modern young women and how they approach sexual harassment. She suggested that in her day, you knew what men were about, you ignored it, you overcame them, you got around them, and you didn't sit around complaining on the internet all day. You just got to it. That was sort of her attitude.
So the workplace, in my opinion, selects for that. That is, women who will go along to get along, who will cast a blind eye, who will simply shrug this kind of sexual intimidation off or downplay it. They become part of the problem in order to get themselves promoted in the career, in order to survive in the workplace. I myself am a boomer, but I applaud millennials for pushing back and pushing back hard on this. I think it's time that we put some teeth into the laws and that we have a workplace that is free of this kind of behavior.
So as we look out across the culture now and this moment that we seem to be in, Dr. Cummins, I wonder if you see a fundamental shift. This question gets asked all the time, right? Whether this is a blip, whether this is a round of reporting and exposures that will fade into the background and the culture will go on as it has, or whether this is a moment that fundamentally changes how this country approaches sexual harassment and sexual assault.
My impression is that we are at a crossroads, and it all depends on how successful millennial women are in pushing back on this. I think if they get beaten down and not taken seriously, then the culture will not change. The fact that they are taking down high-profile men, I think, is probably the single biggest thing that's going to change the culture, because I think men are going to be less likely to try to pursue the strategy if they think it could cost them their jobs or cost them their reputation.
I mean, that's really important, right? Because it seems to me that if we judge success by a couple of Bill O'Reillys or Roger Ailes or Roy Moores, we'll really be missing the point. I mean, this isn't about the famous millionaires as much as it is about the everyday people and the thousands of cases that go on that you never hear about.
Right. Again, and this is just my opinion. I think the fact that men that high profile and that powerful have been taken down for behavior that was normally winked at is probably going to have a great impact on the men who would usually behave that way. Going after the high-profile men is rather important because I think it sends a very clear message that, no, we are taking this seriously, and you can't think that your power and your status somehow gives you carte blanche to engage in this kind of behavior.
Author and researcher Dr. Denise Cummins, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be talking more about workplace sexual harassment tomorrow and why many people don't report it to their own HR departments. We've been hearing your stories.
This is Hillary. In 2001, the president of a small Bay Area company groped me in front of about 15 other employees at a convention. Sadly, I wasn't going to say or do anything. I think that I'd been conditioned to not make a big deal out of things like this. But a few colleagues encouraged me to do so. The company reacted by trying to figure out ways to prove that I wasn't that bothered by it. For example, suggesting that I had seemed happy or was having fun at subsequent events that week. If the same colleagues, including a male counterpart, hadn't backed me up, my complaint would have been completely ignored.
Your stories of harassment in the workplace. Tell us if you've ever reported sexual harassment in the workplace or if you've ever hesitated to report it and why. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.